he was on the jury that gave his wife the, gave her the second Hal Garten Prize. Now, you can't be over 35 when you get that, see. And that year, I had never received the Hal Garten Prize, and that year I was 35. And I sent a landscape. I made it Boothbay Harbor. It overlooked the sea, looking towards Squirrel Island, had some sheep in the foreground, rocks. Wasn't too bad, a great thing. And I had sent it at a good place. And it was the year that Hawthorne got first. This is in the Hal Garten say. And Mrs. Cox got second. And a fellow by the name of Wolfe, man with a violin, got third. And I went into that room knowing that Mrs. Cox was way over 35, madder than a wet hen. You know how youth can get when they think it's outrage. I've always been loud spoken, you know. So I went up to Chase and told him what I thought of the whole damned outfit, A to Z. He tried to shoose me up, you know. Fix it so I would make a row and all that sort of thing. And that year, Kenyon Cox, I told everybody what I thought of him. And first thing I knew, the jury reconvened over there. It had discovered that Mrs. Cox was over 35, her husband had entered it not knowing what her age was. And therefore, they gave me second Hal Garten, Wolfe third, and Hawthorne still first. Hawthorne had a woman in that slapdash way of painting. They put on very freely, very decent thing, and I couldn't curse at that tall. But the better picture of the three in my judgment was the Wolf one, the fellow with the violin. It made me all the madder to think that as long as they'd made this bull, that they didn't shove him up where he belonged. And I told him so. And a lot of them didn't like me. I was always raising hell, creating disturbance, that sort of thing. But if somebody don't say anything, they never change the ways, these birds over there.
Kenyon Cox was never regarded as a very great painter, was he?
None of them were.
He was just sort of a...
Oh, they were politicians.
Yeah.
As I got on the train to go to Pittsburgh for jury work that year, I went down the aisle, and here was Cox seated there. It was a train come from New York. And as I went by, I just stopped, and I said, "Hello, Cox." I said, "I've been saying some things about you, and I'll tell you now just what I said to other people." And I laid it right flat on the line to you. So there was no back of his back or anything like that. I go out there, and what do? They don't. They sort these things out so that they're reconsidered further for prizes and so on and so forth. Or they're out of it, number threes or something, and shoved in a pile, see? They don't no longer consider it for the prizes. Well, Cox fought tooth and nail after that was shoved off to one side and finally prevailed on some of the others to let it stay in so that they could vote on it for medals, see? And it damn near made me sick. And he fought for medals. And the Panama Pacific, I had the same problem. I've had it in plenty of places. And I run into a funny one. I run into Pennell. Pennell had made up his mind to give the gold medal. This is before he sees any pictures at all. He wanted to give the grand gold medal to Cecilia Bowe. As he stated to me, he said, "I'm sick and tired of seeing John Singer Sargent get the thing," and he said, "about time somebody else got it." So I told him, this was over in New York at the Century Club. I said, "As far as I go, I like to look at the pictures before I give any medals." And I let it drop at that. Joe Pennell went to out west, not with a crowd. He went a week ahead. The rest of us went by San Diego to see the exposition, and then on up. Paul Bartle, Mrs. Bartle, all that outfit was there. Chase, greatly, the whole damn business. And Alden Weir, the wife and daughter, two daughters, and a darn fine chap he was, too.
Oh, I should say.
He's a honey.
I liked his work, and I always liked
him. So, you couldn't beat him. We got out there on the very first evening. We were to be entertained at the Bohemian Club, one of the finest clubs there's ever been, because it was truly a Bohemian Club in the best sense of the word. They had great talent. They had good singers, and the art end of things weren't tremendous. They had McComas, a New Zealand man, that did watercolors very well. And a man by the name of Matthews that painted figures. He wasn't particularly bad, but there were very few of them. And here was Pennell there, and he was surrounded by people from Juramen from Brazil and Cuba and various countries in South America had all sent their contributions, and each their man, their juryman, to represent him and that sort of thing. He had them all at a table there. And when we foregathered around the big table to have this big affair, he started in and he said, "Well, we have decided," referring to these South American compatriots, "that the best thing to do regarding the exhibition," I said, "look, Pennell," I said, "don't you think it'd be a good thing before you decide anything to have the other 30 men get together and decide what we're going to do?" He started to stutter. He said, "You know what? Where your place is?" He said, "You go back to Center Bridge and eat peanuts. That's where you belong." So I said, "All right, Jojo." I was calling Jojo, you know, with these whiskers. I said, "Wait till it's all over and see what you think." So he was going to bull everything, you know. He's going to give out the prize and everything in God's world. Bass was there, of course, and Harshey was his assistant, and all that sort of thing. And I'd had considerable to do with organizing the show and working on East with the various committees. And I thought I knew something about it, too. I generally do, as far as that goes. I'm not modest in that respect at all. So Pennell started right in, you know, telling everybody how he thought we should do it, how it should be done, and so on and so forth. Well, I said to me, I said, I think the easiest way, and the simplest way, and the proper way, is to have the watercolor men judge the watercolors and pastels, the miniature men, that sort of thing, the black and white, that sort of thing, the sculptors, their things, and the oil painters, theirs, the various things. Each division elect their chairman, and then they do their work in those rooms, the watercolors, the black and white. Well, he was wild. He didn't want to be here. He was a black and white man, of course, essentially, but he didn't want to be in the black and white. Yeah. He wanted to be out with the oil painters, and he was going to do the Cecilia Bowe stuff and the whole damn business, you know. So he finally was defeated on a vote, and they went off. And I saw Philip Hale and Paxson working openly to get gold medals for their wives, either of them. Both of them were very fair women, as far as it went, and I objected out loud. let everybody know how I felt about that sort of thing. I said, no matter how good their work was, I didn't think it was the right thing to do. And they knew me. And then finally, the final thing is that the whole jury then goes around to the various rooms and the various departments, black and white and what have you, and either okays what that department has done or suggests some change if they want to as a whole thing. If they think things haven't been just the way they should be, either as to placement or anything else. So we got over, we went around, things went pretty smooth. We got over to where the miniatures were. I never claimed to know anything about miniatures in particular. I think maybe I know a good one when I see it, possibly. So I just stood there. They read their list and went around. You see these little things one after the other. I was browsing around, just looking. And finally said to myself, damn, I think this one is just as good as the one I gave a medal to over here. And I said to him, I said, well, what's the matter with this one over here? I said, that looks just as good to me as some of these. And so I proposed it for a medal. And it carried, got a medal. Trask started to laugh. He said, gentlemen, he said, you've heard, really, they call me, protests against the awards that these men were voting for their wives. He said, I just tell you the name of the artist that made this miniature is Heloise Redfield.
You never seen it?
My God, the damnedest thing I ever run into. I had, and the funny part was,
for a few minutes, I'll bet you.
I had met this Heloise Redfield once. She was a student at the Academy of Fine Arts, and I was in there one day looking at the exhibition. She came up and introduced herself. Her name was Redfield. She knew I was Redfield, and asked me which branch I came down and that sort of thing, and I told her. She said her father was either a naturalist or a scientist. Don't know which now. And they lived in West Philadelphia in the street out there, named after him to this day. Well, that's all I ever saw of her. I've never seen her since. I never looked at the damn thing to see who painted or anything else. I didn't know anything about it. But, it's funny, these things. Here's two men that write from New York City a couple of weeks ago. They say this, they saw a couple of pictures of mine in Portland, Maine. And one of them, he said, was painted in Paris in 1900, and it was snowing up a street. I knew the picture immediately. It was one I'd sold to Alfred Pfeiffer. I think I got $75 for it. One of the last ones he ever bought, 2632. Here it was up in Portland, Maine. And he said, he thought the price was around $100 the man wanted for it. I want to get a hold of the picture if I can. How in the hell I'd get up there at that price, I don't know. So one thing led to another, and he wrote in the first place saying that he owned a little red wheel, and had looked me up, I think, in the library up there or something or other, and told me about this Portland thing at the same time, evidently interested. So I wrote back, and I said, any time that they felt like it, they might come down here and bring their picture down. I'd be glad to see them. There was two of them. And about 30 years old. One's a professor, and the other said he pushed a pen. He might be in an office or something, I don't know. Very nice chaps. Well-built, well-conditioned. Didn't drink anything but a little wine, and didn't smoke at all. That type. I'm surprised to come New York, anybody like that, to me anyhow. And I told them, well, I said, they said in the letter, if they come down, why, they'd like to take me out to lunch. And I wrote back and said, no, I said they could come here and we'd have a little something to eat here. If they got here 10, 11 o'clock, be all right with me. But I said, two, they'd have to leave because people come in and play bridge, frank about it. So by George, they show up, brought a gateau and a bottle of wine. Then we had a very nice lunch, and he showed me the picture. And once more, it was one of these, it wasn't too bad. It looks as if it might have been painted by that chap that used to paint the big trees up at, Woodstock.
Frank
Who
Swift
was that?
Chase.
Huh?
Frank Swift Chase.
Big tree?
Well,
Carlson.
No.
Frank Swift Chase.
No. Hmm. Neither of them.
Helen Cochran?
Who?
Cochran. He painted the trees with snow underneath them.
How do you spell it?
C-O-C-H-R-A-N.
No, it may come to me sooner or later, but it won't make a difference. I thought maybe it might be him, but I have even had pictures come up with my name on them. Pearson's brother at Chestnut Hill bought one. He paid $800 for it, pretty good size, at Friedman's out of the sale. I finally sold him one that was the Upper Delaware. I'd never met the man, but got a correspondent, came up and saw it, and I sold him this picture. Wanted me to come down, and I went down to see it, and then he showed me this picture that he had bought for $800. And it was quite dark with a gray day, stormy, rolling clouds, low horizon, tall poplar trees with a cart out in the center. And as soon as I looked at it, I said, that's a funny one. I said, that's for Chauncey Ryder. I said, I was down when he painted the thing. Died, no sale for it, put my name on it. He don't put them on, It's these damn dealers that do.
Huh. Oh, but anybody could recognize the different technique.
Well, anybody had any sense at all should be an entirely different thing to them.
Because they're kind of smooth and...
Clever knife work,
Anybody doing it? Thing about the sign business down there, I thought, not that I wouldn't do anything, but I thought that was one of the funniest things. Spending money in New Hope to get signs to put along the road.
Yeah.
Everybody talking about protecting the beauty of the Delaware Valley, the canal, and what have you, and then put those stinking signs out.
John, you speak up. You haven't said anything.
Huh? I'm just the sound man here.
Well, you ought to be speak up in the sign business.
Well, I'll tell you, you get into some damn funny things. Well, these fellows, amongst other things, they got to talk about different ones, and they knew about Philadelphia, and asked me about this, that, or the other thing. One of them had lived in Camp, New Jersey, where I lived when I was 12 years old. He knew people that I lived next to there, the garrisons and all that outfit, and it struck me as being rather interesting. And
wasn't your picture that they brought down.
Oh, no, I told them. I said it's not a bad little picture as far as that goes, but it's not my picture.
Why do you think it was yours?
Well, snow. They didn't know.
Well,
they had signed it.
Oh, I see.
And so I told him, and they wrote thanking me, of course. And then he said in the note, he said, do you know Aloys Redfield?
After you still, huh?
Hey, that's the reason I happen to think to tell you.
Is she still alive?
Huh?
Is she still alive?
I don't know. I never heard a word about her since. And he said, and do you know Carl Weber?
Makes paint.
And his father also was a painter. And so I wrote him. And I told him about Aloys Redfield, abbreviated a bit. And I told him about Carl Weber. I said when I was 13 and 14, I went up to Bushkill, Pennsylvania. In those days, you went to Stroudsburg, by train. And then you took the bus, which was really a Western bus that you rode on top or inside, had those straps, you know, hung on those things, and bought it from somewhere out west, and they used it on that run there. And the very first day I was up there, I run into this heavy set man, probably 34, 35 years old, with a paint box. And we got to talking, and he asked me if I'd like to watch him work, and I said I would. And I went there and I saw him make these pictures, and by leaving a tree out here and introducing a little dot of color there, maybe changing the shape of the path a little bit, he'd make the most charming little arrangements of just tickled me pink. And I, after that, why, I was his slave. I carried his paint box and that sort of thing for him.
How old were you then?
Coming 14. And I told him that I was studying art. I was at the Spring Garden Institute at that time. And I liked him very much. And when I landed here, there's always been this dreadful confusion as to who landed.
You or Mr. Later?
Of course, it was all damn nonsense from A to Z. Later was perfectly honest about it, because when he landed here, he didn't find me here, see. I had been here for a year damn near, and I lost this child and took my wife to France because she's going down as a living skeleton. Because during that period, he blew in. And he didn't come here on account of me, he come here to Dr. Marshall. He didn't know any more about me than I knew about him. And he always thought, I think to the end, that he came here first. Dr. Marshall came up and talked to me about it towards the end. And I told him just what happened. I said, Lord, anybody who wants to go up to Doylestown, they can see the deed when I bought the property. In May.
Was that his property?
No, the property above. I bought this island and paid a mortgage of $3,000 on it. Wasn't worth $3,000.
What year was that?
Place. That was in
98. Yeah. And you were here a year living on the island?
Well, no, I always lived this side. I put my father on the island. He was a farmer originally, and he had to turn in every damn thing he owned on account of some of these.
Is that the island that
Miller? Oh, yes. I sold it to the Millers.
I've got a tale I can tell you about that island.
Yeah, I sold it to the Millers.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yeah. I got tired of putting up fences at the Freshet store down all the time. And I only got $4,500 out of it. That's all. So they got it cheap enough. But
so then you came here in 98.
Huh?
You came here in 98.
When I got back from France, I landed back here with 35 cents in my pocket.
That was 1900 or 1901?
That was in 1900. Because in 99, Laurent was born, see.
In France?
He was born in France at Alfort, and he was the first child that was born after we lost this girl who was 4 years and a half old. And he was born in France. And we saw the exposition of 1900, and we came back that fall. And
was your father still on the island when you came back?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I had bought the thing, and I paid for the help for him. He was 60-some-odd years old then, and he weighed over 200 pounds when he went on, but he got down to 170 before the 6 months. Planting and nothing in it. He raised turkeys and one thing or other.
Mr. Redfield, in the early 1900s, did you ever run across Alexander or Burge Harrison?
Oh, Lord, yes. Burge, he used to come up there, and he wrote me some very nice letters. He liked my work.
nice, like a father to me.
Nice, what a nice chap he was.
Oh,
he you see, some of these well, people I have here, I know a lot of nice ones.
Yeah.
But we had some dreadful ones. Yes, it. But we never went hungry or anything like that because I fished a good deal, caught a good many bass out of the river in those days. And we used to hunt and trap, and then I always had a garden at home. We had a dozen chickens, and I finally got a little cow. I paid $25 for it. Think of it. I was so poor when I came up here that...
The second time, or the first?
Oh, well, I was poor both times. See, Father had failed. And I sold these pictures to this man, Pfeiffer, in Philadelphia. He was supposed to be a collector, and he told me, he said, made me think that damn sight better than they were, of course. In fact, you don't have to tell youth much about how wonderful they're work is, they all think it's wonderful as soon as they can stick a brush on a canvas. But as you get older, why, you learn a hell of a sight more about what's what in that respect.
What was the name of the man that you watched when you were 14 years old? You like these little...
Carl
things?
Weber.
Weber, Carl Weber.
Carl Weber, yes.
Do I know his name? I don't think I know.
Well, it might be. He's, of course, before your time, you might say. But one of the first things, what got me on this Who Come Here First style, is one of the first things I run into was a picture that was painted at Point Pleasant and it's signed Carl Weber. Now that's way ahead when we were here. And then there was this man Hid up here who was an academician in the 50s.
Yeah.
Lived in, it was the father of Hid up here that had the
lived in Lumberville.
Post office in Lumberville. Yes. And then Innes painted the valley well up early when he was still painting outside and doing something besides those stinking autumn things that he did. But when he went outside and painted one, I want to tell you he painted some good ones.
Isn't Head the one that was made painted flowers?
I don't
birds?
Know. I don't know. I don't know about that. So that.
You go to Booth Bay, don't you?
Yes, I go up there.
Well, did Winslow Homer, didn't he live up there somewhere?
Prout's Neck, Cape Elizabeth.
Oh, that's way
that
down.
That is about, it's about 10 or 11 miles south of Portland,
oh, yes.
Right
yes.
In there.
Yeah, I thought it was...
That is where Alexander Bauer hung out.
Yeah. Oh, I remember his work.
Bauer.
What
did he do?
Oh, he was
Marines.
Cool.
And
Marines?
Sort of
yeah,
thing.
I
remember
vaguely the name.
Well, I had...
He used broken color there,
nicely. I had funny experience with him, too. You see, when Trask was made director of the Philadelphia Sesquicentennial, this was in 26, you know, Bauer, whom he knew pretty well, needed a job. He got him a job and named him assistant director. And I had been working with Trask, more or less, before Bauer come into the thing. I'd been over in New York, and there's some sculptor over there, what was it, Archie Pinko or somebody, some of those people from... Was that sculptor that afterwards had a show in the Metropolitan?
I think
that's
Archie.
That was Pinko, wasn't it?
He was up in Woodstock when I
was he? Well, he didn't speak any English when I first went over there, and I went over to translate. In those days, I used to speak fairly good French. Wife being French, and having lived myself in France nearly 6 years, I'm bound to learn it. Enough so I'd dream it, and rather I'd dream in French rather than English. It became a language for quite a while. But just as soon as Trask got down sick, he was drinking his whiskey pure and cartloads of it. I went went down to see him. He's in Hanneman Hospital. And he said, it was the first day down there. He said, well, the third day, I don't know whether it's pneumonia or something like that, hits in that after the third day, if you get through it, why, maybe it'll be all right. And the mayor's son, Kendrick, had died about 2 months before, also a heavy drinker, with the same complaint. Trey said, if I got through, get through the third day, it'll be all right. And I met his sister there, who was a nurse, not in there, but in New York. And I never did see him again. But then the question came up as to who was to take Trey's place. There was much speculation, and the Ledger came out with an article saying it's rumored that I was going to take it, see, and be art director. And I told another reporter, spoke to him about it. I said, no, I said, I'm not going to take it. I wouldn't take it. I said, that's not my line at all. I said, I'm perfectly willing to help in any way I can. I wouldn't be a director. I'm not qualified for that sort of thing. But I'll do anything I can. So Francis Shunk Brown, he was a member of the art club and one of the big politicians in Philadelphia, Bear Stripe, you know, and Penrose and all that outfit, all the same gang, more or less. Brilliant lawyer. He asked me about it, what they're going to do. He said to Kendrick, the mayor was very much worried. Well, I said, it's late in the game now. I said, inasmuch as Bauer is... I never told Bauer this either. This comes out after people are dead. But I said, inasmuch as he's been working on the thing with Trask, I said, he should be the logical man. And Brown said, if I take you up to see Mayor Kendricks, will you recommend Bauer for the job? I said, sure. So I went up and talked to Kendrick, asked a few questions, and I answered them. And Bauer got the job. But it was understood that I would, you might say, do the work, that is, place all the pictures and arrange the thing. And I used to drive down here. I left here every morning around 4 o'clock in that Ford pickup of mine.
This was the
Sesame Center.
I think I had one.
And I drove down there every day, and I had a gang from the Academy of Fine Arts, the hangers there. I got a man from the art club, and I got a couple from that French fellow that used to handle pictures. And then I just arranged them in panels, so the complementary, the colors were complementary in sizes. And they hung them. And I think it's one of the few things in the sesquicentennial that was ready on opening day. Every picture is in place. And Kendricks came through the day before the official opening, and I was working most of the pictures. And Bauer and the mayor walked by, and nobody said anything to me. I was busy. By and by, the mayor got out, and Bauer came up, and he said, look, Reddy, he said, if I had a chance, I'd introduce you to the mayor. Oh, I said, that's all.
Sounds like an O'Henry story.
But he wasn't very good at all. In the first place, a picture was missing. He couldn't get track of that. And then he was nearly frantic because he found that Trask had agreed to pay the expressage on this Archipinco sculpture that was being shown on the Pacific coast, and it wouldn't be finished out there until sometime in May or June, was later than the opening of this thing anyhow. And they were going to cost a small fortune for the expressage and the insurance on the thing, and some of them were life-size, big marble things, you know. He was in a sweat. Well, I said, there's only one thing to do. I said, we'll go over to New York and see Arch Pinko. So I went over with him. And I said to Arch Pinko that, that we were tying up the loose ends and that we expected to open on this date. I forget just what it was. And he said, well, he said, you understand. He said, my pictures can't be there until it was almost a month later. Well, I said, then I'm sorry, but we can't do that. I said, the pictures have got to be in place. Everything's got to be in place by the opening. So we got out of that in that way. And,
too bad he didn't have some smaller sculptures in New York. He could have given you...
Yeah, sure. But when I was through, I just got in that car and went to Maine. God, I never had such a mess.
Well, this was in the spring and the summer.
It was in the spring.
Yeah.
And in the first place, there's more crooks in it than you could shake a stick at. And Trask had told me, it was the first time I ever knew that he had a crooked bone in his body. And he had plenty. The first time that I knew it was when he said that the Panama Pacific Exposition, that great big fellow that was 6 foot six or eight, sold pictures to the NAD for a while. He was the director of the Portland exposition out there. I think it was Portland on the Pacific coast. And and he said that he had through the choice of stone for certain buildings, he'd given the contract to a man that had paid him God knows how many thousand dollars if he would recommend this stone. And two or three other tricks that this fellow had pulled off, he made himself a fortune.
Yeah.
And Trask said to me, he said, this is where I make mine. That's the first time I ever knew that he was crooked. And dead or alive, I call him. I'll tell you that, to make a damn bit of difference.
I met him once, must have been just a year or two before his death. He was up in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
My
God. Got him to go up there to auction off a bunch of paintings for the North Shore Arts Association.
Did they?
Yeah, he did a good job.
Oh, yeah. Very able. Make us think about that.
Well, he ran the academy
wonderfully
well
clever.
For years.
Mm-hmm. There's nobody that knew anything more about handling pictures, getting up a show, use the men fine on the jury always. You ought to have a halo for the way he used everybody. But when it got right down to the final thing, he
wanted his, huh?
Well, before that, we had this exposition in Argentine. That was early. And I had sent a picture down there and it sold. It hangs there today. And he sold one for Tommy Anschutz. No, he didn't sell one for Tommy Anschutz. He sold a couple of others. The one of Tommy Anschutz got dusted a bit. It was a pastel in shipment. And Trask had put in a claim for it and got the full price of the picture. And then he settled for Anschutz for about $200 or $300 less than what he collected. I found that out afterwards. And nice little things like that.
Mr. Redfield, I'll never get out a second edition of this, but this is what I say about you. Edward Willis Redfield first came to the area in the summer of 1887, when he and other young men camped for a while on Bull's Island opposite Lumberville.
That is correct.
After studying in France and acquiring a French wife, he returned for good in 1898.
Returned to where?
Returned for good in 1898.
Yeah.
Buying what is known as Hendricks Island near Center Bridge, and later establishing his home and studio on the mainland opposite.
Yeah.
Of the fine artists who came here at the turn of the century, Mr. Redfield, Elizabeth Friedland, and Emma Elizabeth Price alone remain. A member of the National and letters. And at the National Academy of Design, Mr. Redfield has won more prizes and has hung in more permanent collections than any of his successors. There is hardly a major prize that has escaped him. Among the some 25 galleries where his work may be seen are the Luxembourg, Metropolitan, Corcoran, and Carnegie.
Yeah.
Is that all
accurate? One of the Metropolitan is seldom seen in Sir Rotter. But that is one of these queer things, too. That was sold out of my room. I had a room up Panama Pacific, setting in with a favored few. And they sold $24,000 worth of my work out of that room. I was high man out there. And amongst others that bought was Mrs. Harriman. And I suppose Trask or the attendant young lady, his secretary or somebody, probably told Mrs. Harriman, here's a struggling young artist who lives along the banks of the river and cuts his own firewood and fishes his fish and raises his stuff in the garden. And probably she bought it to help some struggling artist along. Not wanting it, she offers it to the
Metropolitan
Museum. Now, the Metropolitan Museum didn't want it for a single second, but all they could see is the vast amount of money that the Harrimans have and the chance they have of making a big scoop by sitting on the floorboards. So they take the picture and they hang it on the second line. I go over and look at it. It looks like a bunch of worms to me. It was an early one. And I say, the hell with that. And then, a little later on, they write me and they say that they have so many pictures there, American pictures, especially in the Hearn collection, that they want to send them out on the road, see? And would I object to sending my picture out in that collection? And I wrote back to them and I told them, I said, never send any picture of mine out in the Hearn collection. I said, he never could buy one from him when he's alive, and I certainly don't want to associate with other pictures he's bought when he's dead. I put it that straight to him. And I thought I would see them sometime. And talk the thing over, offer him a decent picture, make a swap with him or something else, you know. I tried to get in touch with the man that was there. I forget what his name
Taylor?
Was. Who?
Taylor?
Taylor, I guess. Well,
he's dead now.
Well, God rest his soul. He was either out to lunch, or I couldn't get my foot in the door, couldn't even see his secretary. There's a guard outside. This was in the Second World War. Told him what I wanted, one thing or other, and I got damn good and mad. And, I let it go at that. But I hate like hell to have things out that I know are not right.
Is it still there?
Oh, I suppose in the cellar someplace, gathering cobwebs, I don't know.
Catch the wind. Put down your arm.
No.
Walk out with it.
Stinkers. Then you have this squirt down there, Williams and Corcoran Gallery now. Do you ever see those catalogs he sends out?
No.
The stuff they're exhibiting? Before we go out, I'll show you one. By golly, of all the scratches and pimples that they frame now, to call pictures and award medals to.
Oh, well.
Well, I say to everybody, I don't care whether you're a modern painter or who it is, if you come in here, I'll tell you what I think of it. I always say the same thing. Take a baby's diaper when it's had a good passage and frame it and send it out, has just as much merit as anything the two boys are making, in my judgment. Too damned easy to make all the way through.
No,
Dorothy,
no,
I said,
say whether it's right or wrong or anything about it.
I wouldn't even argue about the damn thing. The point I make is that when you get to the point of where any about it, take a pot of black paint and paint the surface of your canvas black, stick it in the canvas and send it to the Chicago Art Institute and get a prize for it, first prize, please.
I saw that thing.
All right.
Big black canvas.
All right. Now, they don't seem to even think that's funny. Here, you can go back 67 years ago when the Philadelphia Record was published in Philadelphia on Chester Street, the side of 9th, north side. And in those days, your opening day, vernissage and all that sort of thing, there were occasions. The papers were full of reproductions of works of art and all that sort of thing. Supposed to be works of art, exhibition stuff, you know. You'd get two or three pages of reproductions and write-ups for the Academy. And then they had, this fellow made caricatures of some of the pictures. And he had a wall of pictures, say, like that, home in his little drawing. Then he had titles of them. And under this one, when the Philadelphia Record was published in Philadelphia, on Chester Street, the side of 9th, north side. And in those days, your opening day, vernissage and all that sort of thing, there were occasions. The papers were full of reproductions of works of art and all that sort of thing. Supposed to be works of art, exhibition stuff, you know. You'd get two or three pages of reproductions and write-ups for the Academy. And then they had, this fellow made caricatures of some of the pictures. And he had a wall of pictures, say, like that, home in his little drawing. And then he had titles of them. And under this one, which was just a blank canvas, see, not a thing on it, he had Fog on the Delaware by Bertie McGluck. And that stuck for me all these years. Now, this is a proposition. Everybody that's ever painted, you can go back to Vermeer. They talk about photography and art and that sort of thing. You go back to Vermeer and you look at that thing of his and those figures and the beads and one thing or other, beautifully painted. Swell arrangement. Carried as far, seems to me, as anybody can possibly do. There's not a word of fault that I can find about it. I'm against the academic thing and regular Academy stuff that you see over there is enough to make you puke. I don't know how it is late years, but what it used to be. They're just tin. Might be enlargements from photographs, tinted and all that sort of thing is what they look like to me. They never had any life to them. Once in a while, there's an exception. But the Cox outfit and all those were poor. But
this thing, you
go into Paxson then. Paxson also licked him up, don't you see? Mm. Very smooth. And I know him very well, and he's always very frank and about things. And he's always... were getting the popular prizes. He and Fred Wall were getting the popular prizes all over the United States. Yeah. That's where the public votes, you know.
Paxson was very nice to me when I was a young fellow.
Well, he was a swell guy.
He was very nice.
He's a damn nice guy.
I knew him up in Provincetown.
He was and one of the wittiest that the art world has ever produced. And he was down in Washington, the opening. I'd been chairman of the jury once more. And coming back, we came back on the same train. clerk that gave the prizes was supposed to go back with us, but he found that he was going the B&O and we were on the Pennsylvania, so he didn't get back together. We got into the smoker and sat down there, and Paxton said, "Ready." He said, "How is it I never get any prizes on these juries anyhow?" And I said, "Look, Paxton, I want to tell you something. I have never yet told anybody how I voted on juries or how other people voted on juries. But I said, in this case, I'm going to tell you that I didn't vote for your picture. And I said, I think that where it belongs is on the outside cover of the Ladies Home Journal." And he commenced to shoot off like fireworks. He said, "Ready?" He said, "I'll tell you what your trouble is." He said, "You stop where it commences to get hard." Well, I said, "Look, I think that you don't stop soon enough." So I said, "Evidently, there's a difference of opinion. Now, I'll grant that what you say about me is correct, but I'll gamble that you won't say that what I say about you is correct." And he said, "Certainly not." Well, the sequel to that thing was this. Within 6 months, that picture was reproduced by the Ladies Home Journal in Philadelphia, but it was inside, and it was a double page. Man seated at the breakfast table, newly married they were, reading a newspaper, his wife sitting here, very pretty, very well done, the thing, pouting, you know, window, outdoors, gay, swell job. But it just looked like a colored illustration to me. If I saw it now, I think after seeing this other stuff, I think I'd say it for all. But
his work was always very finished.
Oh yes, you couldn't see a hair.
No, he took great delight in turning that arm around, you know, modeling it just so.
All of them, of course, were intensely interested in Vermeer, and all of them were trying to. They thought that section here, where the woman's hair went into her neck, was the most difficult thing to do. And Tarbell did one, hung in the art club in Philadelphia for a number of years. Woman with a turquoise ring. Beautiful thing. Probably sold at the sale they had down there for a couple of $100. Lord, I wish I'd been there. But there was a Mrs., I don't know whether her name was Ferrer or some such damn thing. Minigro never told me her real name. But Paxton was very popular, and he was painting these things all over Washington. I know this people down here at Trenton that runs a Trenton newspaper. She used to live up here. Oh, the editors, the owners of the Trenton Daily, something or other.
Burn, begin with a B.
No, I don't. Irish name, and there's a submarine named after it. Well, anyhow, he painted her husband. After he died, Paxton made 5 more of them, copies from her. She asked me to come up and see him.
He'd get there so far on the head, this would be all bare canvas, and he'd go straight on down.
Well,
clever as all get out.
He painted this woman down there, and it was the usual society, you know, a pretty good job, as he made them. Was accepted at the Academy, invited by Minigro, by some society woman, well known, wealthy. And the same year, he made a nude of one of the Sullivan sisters. You see, the Sullivan sisters used to pose for all those boys up there in the studios there. I forget the name of them. And it got the popular prize. See, lovely, peachy, pink thing. And this lady wrote Paxton and wanted to know how it was that she hadn't gotten the prize, see? And I don't to remember just what the jingle was, but he wrote of this thing in a jingle in verse, you know. And he said something about Mrs. Ferrer being fairer, but whatever the title of the other one was, much fairer. I mean, it all rhymes together, but I know just what it was, but that's the way it came out anyhow. But he'd do that sort of thing. And,
you know, Mrs. Paxton is still alive, I think, isn't she?
She might be.
Her name was up for an associate of the National Academy, I think, 3 years ago.
Well,
and
they were both pretty good painters.
Both
Paxton and Lillian Hale.
Yes.
Oh, yes, they were both pretty good painters. I see Morris Young is still up as an associate. Well, he's older than I am. I believe so, yeah. Now, I read here recently where he lost 70 or 80 paintings in a fire in his studio.
Oh,
yeah.
Where do you get these big stretchers?
Well, there's a place over in New York, used to be in Brooklyn, I think they're on Long Island now. I don't know whether that's one of them or not. But I run into all sorts of things, you know. I run into a portrait up there in an antique shop, some old lady kept on Pemaquid Point. And I recognized it as soon as I saw it. Portrait by Joseph de Camp. Head of a woman, rather dark, she's young, pretty. Don't know whether she had a flower in her hand or whether she had one on her coat now anymore. And it was about 25 or 30, upright. And it had a carved wood frame on it, made by that fellow that used to make the frames there in Boston. What is his name? He just charged him about $100 for a frame that size. They all got their frames from him. Well, I recognized the frame, recognized the thing. I was in there trying to get some couple of historical plates that she had that I wanted. And I saw this by Joseph de Camp, $60 on a card about big stuck in the edge of the frame. And I said to myself, well, hell, I said, that'd be cheap for the frame. And I got the plates and went through the door, settled where she's crippled, sat there in the chair. I said, I see you have a portrait by a friend of mine back there, Joseph de Camp. I said, I know him quite well. He said, why don't you buy it? Oh, I said, it's too expensive for me. He said, what would you give for it? I said, $30. He said, all right, it's yours. So I brought it down here. And I turned it face in and had a frame on it. And there was a party came in here. I won't tell you who it is. Came in here and they bought 4 of my pictures, and they did something that most people don't do in the studio or anybody's studio. They went turning things around. And they turned around this Josie de Camp. And she said, oh, I like that. I said, you like it? I said, yes, by somebody I know quite well, Joseph de Camp. And I said, it has a sticker on the back of the frame showing that it was shown in an international show in Munich. So the artist must have thought it was pretty good. It was entitled Sally. You know, his wife or his daughter, I don't know which now. He said, what do you want for it? Well, I said, I hadn't thought about selling it, but it would take $500 for it. He said, all right, I'll take it.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good story.
Well, now, I got another one that I'll show you.
But I don't look at that too.